Okay. Tanya, you ready? Mark, you ready?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, let's call the case and get going.
Okay, now call the state of Texas versus Fountain Valley Park Jr. May please support Ms. Tanya Dahomey, who will argue for the state, Mr. Mark Gable, who will argue for the athlete.
All right, thank you. Tanya?
May it please the court. I am here today on behalf of our elected criminal district attorney, Sharon Wilson, and we prosecute this appeal in order to reverse the trial court's ruling on a motion to suppress. And of course, this is a state appeal, an interlocutory appeal. You can see in my brief that it's divided substantively into two different sections, one that involves the findings of fact and conclusions of law and the affidavit itself, and the probable cause question, and then another section that involves the, for lack of a better word, the jurate. Truly, I consider a jurate the person who is sworn to, but the claim that was made at the trial court level that there was a false statement in the affidavit, in the warrant. So first approaching the first section.
Wait a minute, false statement in the affidavit?
No, in the warrant, Your Honor, I misspoke.
Yeah, okay.
There's multiple standards that this court is very familiar with as far as how you review probable cause that's in a search warrant affidavit. And there is a case, instead of using my words, I thought I would use this court's words. And this court's words in a recent PC opinion, I must admit I kind of like the opinion because the defendant's name is Josie Wales Parks, and the minute we saw it, we were like, don't name your child Josie Wales or they're going to be an outlaw. But it's just a PC opinion that has the exact same standards we're applying here. And this court, Justice Dauphineau, you're on that panel, but it's two other justices. But it succinctly says that when the trial court determines probable cause in support of the issuance of a search warrant, there are no credibility determinations. And that's, of course, referring to the Court of Criminal Appeals' McLean opinion, another state appeal. And, in fact, the trial court is constrained by the four corners of the affidavit. That's not new law. That's Illinois versus Gates that we all learn in law school. That's the limitation for considering the probable cause question. Then, of course, in your Josie Wales Parks opinion, it talks about deference to the magistrate who issued the search warrant and cites Gates, of course. I like a line later on in the next paragraph where it talks about courts are not allowed to look at affidavits, and that would be reviewing courts, whether it be the trial court or the Court of Appeals. They're not allowed to look at an affidavit in a hyper-technical manner, and that's actually from Gates. And in fact, then this court goes on and says, when in doubt, we defer to all reasonable inferences that the magistrate could have made. In my brief, I came up with a term that I call tie goes to the magistrate. Okay, I don't think this is a close case on what was contained within the search warrant affidavit. But even if it is, under some lens, a close case, then tie goes to the magistrate's decision. But here we have time of stop, 2:43, that's the middle of the night. I give you a case out of this court, Arthur, which says time of stop is certainly a calculation when read in context with all the others. Speeding, 61 and a 45. You know, lots of people who are good, innocent people speed. But you know what? That doesn't matter. We know that from the Supreme Court in Arvizu, one of my favorite cases that I've talked to this court about many times, which discusses it doesn't matter about the innocent interpretation if the officer had a non-innocent way of looking at that. And it, in this case, it certainly goes within the context. Loss of normal use of physical faculties, inability to push a gas pedal appropriately, or how about the loss of mental faculties? Stupid to speed down the street, which has the police station on it in the middle of the night. Either of those. But here also, odor of alcohol, which the officer said, and Dyer is the Court of Criminal Appeals case that is relied on for most of those classic symptoms of alcohol, of intoxication.
What do you understand the statement, an unknown odor of an alcoholic beverage? To me, That confused me. What's your understanding of the meaning of that?
Well, several things, Your Honor. First off, I would instantly refer back to Gates, which talks about these affidavits are written by untrained lawyers, or not lawyers. They're not written to the precise wording that we would put in an opinion or a brief. They're written by lay people that are officers. But also, when it says unknown odor of alcohol, that possibly means he didn't know if it was a margarita or beer or Chateaubriand. And of course, we know the officer doesn't have to say this person had 6 shots of tequila, and that's what I smelled. It's an unidentifiable odor. It's still an odor of alcohol. So, and I think also I would refer back to Gates, because if you just hone in on that one statement.
No, I was just curious. I just found it confusing. I thought you might have an understanding of what that meant.
I believe I've said this to you before, Justice D'Offano. If I had perfectly written out facts or perfect cases, we wouldn't be here.
Right.
But unknown odor of alcohol is not a problem. I think Dyer really is very close on facts, because it just talks about odor of alcohol. And in this situation, we have someone who admits to drinking. So we don't have to know the quantity, the quality, what type of alcohol it was, any of those facts. We don't even have to know when it happened. All of the things that the trial court put into the findings of fact, that's not what we look at. What we look at was what was in the actual affidavit. And here, where someone says, I had been drinking, and of course when an officer comes up to someone and says, when they've stopped them in the middle of the night and says, have you been drinking, it would be an unreasonable inference to think that the officer was asking if he'd had a hot chocolate with marshmallows on top earlier. That's patently unreasonable. And of course we know the fact findings include some assertions about various types of drinks. But when you look at that admission in light of the fact that the officer smelled alcohol, then that makes them both even more reasonable, along with the fact that this person had an inebriated passenger. And that was the one factor I didn't have a case on point. I would love this court to write on that, because I found the Williams case where the fact that the person had an inebriated passenger went into the sufficiency of the evidence analysis, but obviously that's not what we're talking about here. That's a higher standard. Certainly if people are out together drinking, which this defendant said he'd been drinking, and he smelled of alcohol, and he had someone with him, that tells you again, it's more reasonable that the officer believed this person had been drinking. Other classic symptoms, slurred speech, bloodshot eyes, unspecified field sobriety test failure. Of course, Justice D'Offano, I would have loved for this officer to have spelled out 6-6 whatever on all of the field sobriety tests. It means it's less weight than an affidavit that has all of those factors spelled out. But actually on the affidavit, it's consistent with the check mark later on the affidavit that says yes, field sobriety tests were given. There's no specific details below there. There doesn't have to be. It would have been great had there been. I would be much happier as far as this, and I would be saying ample support. But in this situation, you still have so many factors that show this police officer had a substantial basis for believing that the person had committed DWI. And then we get to the factor at the end, breath test refusal. That's in the affidavit twice, in the part that in the probable cause section that the officer included, and then in the boilerplate language too. It's funny, if you look at the findings of fact, both the proposed by defense and the ones by the trial, they don't include that factor. Okay, we know that prosecutors can get up and argue this person didn't take the test because they knew they were intoxicated. I believe the Gaddis case, which came down the week I was trying a no refusal DWI in 1988, said the game's over, and allowed comment on the fact that someone refused. And of course we know that's appropriate from Pennsylvania versus Muniz and South Dakota versus Neville. It's a factor that can be considered. Someone chooses not to give the officer the BAC evidence because they're intoxicated.
What about the Texas constitutional prohibition against requiring a defendant to provide evidence as opposed to testify provide evidence against himself. Does Texas have a different standard?
No, it doesn't. Heitman, of course, would be the case from 1993 that discussed where the Constitution departs federally and state. And basically one of the only, there may be one other, but one of the only places where Fourth Amendment departs is on consent. You have clear and convincing higher standard because of the wording of the Texas Constitution for consent, not on the Fourth Amendment. It's always been seen as lockstep, and in fact, and in, as far as Fifth Amendment Sections 2, which of course is South Dakota versus Neville. Also, these sorts of questions are not seen as the type of evidence you're mentioning. They're seen as attendant to questioning and investigation. So no, I do not believe that that's a problem. And it's since Gaddis was in 1988 and has been used by me dozens of times and probably hundreds, if not thousands of times by other prosecutors, there's not a problem. The bottom line here is that in this situation, the trial court read all of the inferences against the standard that Illinois versus Gates requires, all of them. It's actually a pretty shocking set of findings and conclusions. It's a classic divide and conquer sort of attack that is, again, back to Illinois versus Gates. It's funny to go back and read such an older case that we rely on all the time and we don't actually go back and always look at it. Illinois versus Gates shows this court has to uphold this magistrate's determination that there was probable cause and reverse the trial court on that issue. It is actually irrational and an abuse of discretion for the trial court's extra contextual outside the four corners inferences to have been made in the way that they were. Are there any questions on the first substantive part of my brief? Turning to the second part, Connie Langston is the magistrate who signed this warrant. This would be the part of the evidence that was appropriate to have witnesses, and in fact, Mr. Daniel asked the police officer, Rafael Suarez, about questions pertaining to the manner that the affidavit was obtained. And in doing so, I think it's an interesting part of the record to read because from that stance, he has the officer basically come down and say, yes, this made before me section is the recital at the top of the search warrant. This made before me section is false. And actually, he talks about the L word. The Clay case was discussed, the Court of Criminal Appeals Clay case, a case out of Hill County, a case that has a factual distinguishing part, but still supports the state's position in the second half of this. In Clay, it involved the jurat. And when I talk about an affidavit, then an officer swears that this is a true and correct affidavit, and then another person, according to 602 of the government code, signs. And it could be the magistrate, or it could be a police officer, or it could be a notary, and there's another line of people there. And in that's what Clay involved, was that jurat. Here we're talking about the actual signature on the warrant. And in this situation, still, the word before, that is the legal definition of before, found in Black's Dictionary for the first time in 1990, that was news to me when I read Clay, that shows you don't have to be physically present in the interpretation of before. Court of Criminal Appeals decision saying that. That's what was the Judge Langston's finding. She was faxed during a no-refusal weekend, this affidavit, and then she read it, and we know she read it because she also signed the affidavit and said she found sufficient evidence to show PC on that. She signed it again on the search warrant. This magistrate did everything right. And, in fact, under Clay, the affidavit was before the magistrate.
So you're saying the magistrate, that the appellant had no right to question the magistrate, and the magistrate acted correctly in ignoring the subpoena and refusing to appear?
May I respond? Well, I do not think that's what the record shows. In fact, you'll notice if you go through, The trial court's findings of fact on the subpoenas are incorrect and an abuse of discretion. There are half a dozen subpoenas issued because there's different dates set. In this case, there actually was a hearing and subpoenas issued. There were two different subpoenas for Connie Langston for the July 2nd hearing. Neither shows a return that was successful. The return for the first one that Mr. Daniel requested was returned not served. The second one that someone named T. Moore signed for Mr. Daniel does not have a return for it. So it is incorrect to say that this was a duly served subpoena. May I finish?
Please.
And so totally, there were five subpoenas issued, two returns, the one for the February 11th date also. There is nothing showing a fax to Judge Langston. There is nothing showing service by fax for any of the three settings.
What about the evidence that she talked to Letitia Brown?
That was not evidence, Your Honor. That was Mr. Daniel stating for the record. And, of course, we all know that assertions of counsel, when taken as true and uncontested, are taken as true by courts of appeals. But you'll note that Rachel Ackerman said right after Mr. Daniel discussed all of this that she disagreed with many of the things he was saying. So the state contested those assertions, and actually the record contests those assertions as well. The record does not bear out that this magistrate actually even was served properly or did not show up because Mr. Daniel walked away from presenting her, which is the other requirement in 2402. And so I completely disagree with those fact findings and believe that this court should say those were an abuse of discretion.
No. Thank you. Mark?
Court counsel, my name is Mark Daniel. I have the privilege of representing Scott Crawford in this matter today. And I want to tell the court initially this is a very simple, very narrow issue that's before the court to be decided. And it's whether or not the court will follow a well-established, well-settled principle of law or whether it will depart from that. And that principle, as you all know, is when a trial court makes a ruling in connection with a motion to suppress evidence, that ruling withstands scrutiny on this level as long as it is, as long as this court is giving deference the law requires, and it should be upheld as long as it is supported by facts in the record and not some theory of law that would be completely inapplicable. And it's only to be disturbed if two things exist. Number one is an abuse of discretion, and number two, that abuse of discretion must rise to the level of being outside the zone of reasonable disagreement. We use that term frequently, and what that really means is that reasonable, rational people could not even reach a point of disagreeing civilly about that particular fact or that circumstance or that issue. And there's a number of cases that follow that. Y'all have read them. Y'all are familiar with them. Weed, Kelly, Guzman, they're on page 9 of my brief. Armendariz, Arthur, Martinez, Dixon. So to overturn what the trial court did, it almost has to border on being something outrageous, not only from a factual standpoint, but also from a legal standpoint. There was a hearing held in County Criminal Court number 4 last July 2nd. There was a ruling made by the trial court on the 3rd of July. And then at my request to do factual findings, conclusions of law, it was not until a month later that Judge Necom of County Criminal Court number 4 issued very carefully considered, thorough, comprehensive findings of facts, conclusions of law. And I don't say this as a criticism, but as I was reading the state's brief, the appellant's brief, that standard is almost glossed over. It's buried 32 pages back in a 39-page brief. It's like y'all are supposed to simply ignore all that. And the fact of the matter is, not only was it thorough and carefully considered, it was supported by the record, it was supported by the law, it was not abuse of discretion, and it certainly was not some departure that reasonable people could not agree upon. I know this court in preparing for arguments today has gone through the record. I know you've seen her factual findings, her conclusions of law. She spent 9 pages She addressed every pertinent fact. She addressed all the law that was to be considered. And I'm not going to break it down line for line. It's not that important. But it begins on paragraph 21. And she finds there that, yes, there was a question mark in her mind from the standpoint of when the warrant says, before me appeared, or signed before me, when the officer himself said, I never saw that lady. I don't know who she is. I never met her. I swore that out in front of Officer Abredo, and I'm sure I'm mispronouncing his name, and it was faxed to Judge Langston, whoever she is or wherever she was. He didn't know those things. It's some non-refusal weekend where they have judges available in far-off distant places nobody even knows. And frankly, the trial court didn't go call Judge Langston some absconder. She said that basically that causes me to have a legitimate question about whether she even read the warrant itself that she issued. Because if she'd read it, she would have seen. I need to correct that misstatement. And it was a misstatement. I probably went too far in making the officer say that would be an L, but that's what he said. She goes on in paragraph 22 to say this is not only poorly drafted, it does not reach the level of even supporting probable cause. And then she starts breaking down all the specific facts that go into that finding. It starts off with there's a speeding violation. She makes a distinction of there's no erratic driving, there's no somebody weaving in lines or running over curbs or straying outside of the line or ambivalently driving on down the road after the officer tries to stop them. There's the mental abilities to respond to the officer. She's go forward to talk about this issue that Justice Dofano just mentioned, this alcoholic beverage. Well, he says an unknown alcoholic beverage odor. She says she didn't say it was weak, didn't say it was moderate, didn't say it was strong. The warrant itself doesn't even say where the parties were when that little fact was detected. More importantly, and I will correct what the appellant said y'all a minute ago, because this warrant does not say I observed bloodshot eyes. What it says, quote unquote, is I saw, quote, what appeared to be bloodshot eyes. And we heard Illinois versus Gates cited to y'all about six times in the last 15 minutes. Illinois versus Gates is a seminal opinion in our Fourth Amendment issued by the Supreme Court in 1983. And frankly, when all of y'all went to law school and I went to law school, it wasn't in our jurisprudence, but it is now since 1983. And it gave us the principle of our Fourth Amendment requires, and it's in our Code of Criminal Procedure, exact same language, it's in our Fourth Amendment, there must be facts. And the court distinguished between facts and conclusions. A fact is like a brick you lay down. You lay another one next to it and you lay it on top of it to build yourself to a conclusion. You must have facts that underlie conclusions. That's what Illinois versus Gay says. This statement of what appears to be bloodshot eyes is sure not a fact. What does that say? What does that tell you? It tells me nothing. It's speculative at best. Speculation is not even really a conclusion. She goes on to break it down. We talk about the statement of drinking. There's no facts about were you drinking alcohol? What was the quantity you were drinking? What time frame were you drinking? And there's no, I mean, I'll tell y'all, I was drinking today. I went to lunch. I had a glass of water with my lunch. It was good. But that's not information that would lead to anybody thinking there's some conclusion or decision that I'm intoxicated to any degree. But the most important thing that Judge Neacom did in her findings of fact conclusions of law is in paragraphs 33 through 39. It's the gravamen of the deficiency in the probable cause. She focuses on a sentence that says, Officer Suarez asked Mr. Crawford to exit the vehicle to perform SFST. Doesn't say standardized field sobriety, says SFST. And the warrant's attached to her findings, which Crawford failed. And frankly, I don't mean to spin on the head of a pen, but does that mean he failed to exit the vehicle or he failed to do SFST, whatever that is? You can't tell by reading the text. And Judge Neacom went further and talked about SFST. And I have sat in these courts that sit floors below y'all and heard prosecutors say such things as these abbreviations are okay because Hogan said it's okay. And Hogan's opinion came out of this court in 2010, and Justice Livingston authored it. and it didn't say a single thing about abbreviations are okay. It actually condemned the use of abbreviations. The only reason Hogan was upheld is Justice Livingston said there's other facts within the opinion that are sufficient to establish probable cause separate apart from that. And we don't condone the simple use of abbreviations. Well, here we all know what SFST means because we've lived in that world. We don't know what just Langston knew or did not know, but you drill on down and you can't tell what he did to fail, which is a violation of Illinois versus Gates. You have to be able to have a fact. You ought to be able to at least form a mental picture of what this officer observed. And we have asked to do SFST, he failed. What did he do? What do we know? What information do we have in front of us? We know that Judge Langston didn't have any more than this affidavit. What could she know about that? Really nothing. We don't know what tests were given. We don't know what he did that constituted failure. We don't know, as Judge Niekum pointed out, we don't know if this man's certified. He did say earlier that he's certified to operate a radar. That's outstanding. That's tremendous. I'm glad he is. But if he's doing SFST, if they really are standardized field sobriety tests, he has to have some certification. And that information is not even included in the warrant, much less the affidavit. But more importantly, Judge Niekum drops down to paragraph 40 and kind of gets off into a common sense application. It's paragraph 40 of her findings. And she discusses things that you commonly see in these arrests. You see problems with balance, problems with standing, problems with walking, illogical thought process where you don't process information good, you don't follow instructions. And she points out there's not a single thing in there that shows me any sway, any staggering, any unsteadiness, any problems with balance, any problems with walking, any falling down, none of that.
And she also— Aren't there cases that say, though, that you don't look at what's missing in the affidavit, you look at what is in the four corners of the affidavit?
Yes, you can, but when you determine the probable cause and there's some degree of intoxication allegation, the court can certainly consider those things, the trial court, of what's missing, which is all she said. She wasn't saying what she would like to be there. She's saying what was not there that might have provided her information to determine probable cause. And she said they were clearly absent. She's pointing out the deficiencies that exist time and time again throughout the affidavit. Very telling, as this court reviews this, take a look at that affidavit again, because on down at the bottom, where we have these SFSTs, there's a question area for a pre-prepared box checking, is what I call it. And it has an area in there where it says, were field sobriety tests given? Box to check, yes. And then right below that, it has field sobriety test comments. There's two lines that the officer can write to his heart's content. And there's another whole inch or inch and a half on the next page, which would be page 2 of 2 of the affidavit, that he could fill in whatever detail and fact he wanted to provide the magistrate. Those are sitting there blank. And there's just this rational inference that the person went and actually performed fine on those tests. At least you have conflicts within the affidavit, and Judge Niekum saw that also. In paragraphs 41 through 46 of her findings, Judge Niekum did exactly what the appellant said she did not do. She begins by saying, I'm applying a deferential standard, which I'm required to do. And I don't find probable cause to exist in this search warrant affidavit under Article 1, Section 9, or the Fourth Amendment. And she should be—
Do you agree that applying a deferential standard is generally the law?
Yes, ma'am.
In your brief, you say, quote, any deference the trial court was required to give the issuing magistrate is diminished, if not eliminated, when the magistrate didn't read the warrant. Do you have any authority whatsoever for that statement?
Yes, ma'am, I actually do. Magistrate Langston was subpoenaed to appear. Ms. Tahoney can sit here and say all day long she wasn't served. She was actually served by facsimile.
Is that in our record? Anything to show she was actually served?
I believe it is. And there is a statement in the beginning of the hearing where I'm with my co-counsel who worked diligently to get this served, and he was talking with the assistant city attorney, who said, yes, she's been served, we will have her there. And then she calls back to my office and she says, I ain't coming, quote unquote. And you'll see in the record where I make my proffer to the court about all the things that are developed in connection with this. And I say, Mr. McCracken's here to sponsor that, Your Honor. Is that all correct, Mr. McCracken, which is a statement of counsel which can be construed as accurate? So yes, the record does support that. And I guess the question is, why should you give deference to their findings when they stiff or defy your compulsory process to appear in your court? And I guess I could have plucked her out of the family court, brought her over there. Frankly, the record I was satisfied with as it stood at the time. But in paragraph 46, Judge Neekum should be commended. She says the Fourth Amendment demands more. You don't tolerate sloppiness, you don't cut corners, which is very similar to what the Supreme Court told us in McNeely, which now almost 2 years ago, that when you extract blood from a human's body, it triggers the Fourth Amendment. Excellence should be demanded of that process. If you go through the 9 pages of her findings, if you go through the 46, 47 paragraphs, there is nothing that the trial court found that is an abuse of discretion. There is nothing the trial court found, if you go over every line, every sentence, that would be outside some zone of reasonable disagreement. And I'd ask the court to uphold the Fourth Amendment, to give it the dignity it deserves, and to affirm the trial court's ruling. Thank you.
Tanya?
Merely because Mr. Daniel used these terms, I am going to submit that the findings of fact that were given in this case border on outrageous and are an abuse of discretion. They are repudiation of the standards in Gates, State versus Duarte, McLean, you name it. Almost any case from this court and the Court of Criminal Appeals and other courts of this state that talk about the standards when reviewing a search warrant affidavit, the totality, the looking at the what's not in the affidavit, Justice Gabriel, as you said, as opposed to what's in the affidavit. And in fact, in Davis, the Court of Criminal Appeals decision in 2006, which is in my brief, in that situation, the officer was just identified generically. And so the court looked at, they actually wrote a question. Could the magistrate reasonably infer that the officer named in the affidavit was a trained, commissioned police officer? Well, yes. Affidavit just said officer on patrol in Nakona. And the holding was that it did not distort common sense or read additional facts into the affidavit to infer from this information that Westervelt, the officer, was a local police officer. Nor was it unreasonable to infer that the person identified certain smells, et cetera, things like that. It was a meth affidavit, not DWI in that case. And it goes on in Davis to say any reasonable inference is required for this court to review, or any reviewing court, and why. We didn't touch about why. Reference to McNeely gets there a little bit, because we are honoring the Fourth Amendment gold standard that warrants be preferred. That's why there's deference. That's why you don't look outside, you look inside the affidavit. That is what is important in this case. As for the second substantive issue, involving the Connie Langston. You know, it's funny because when you go back and read the record, it's not a very big record. Of course, Mr. Daniel went through all of his assertions that suggested that that Ms. Langston was absconding from the subpoena. And then Rachel Ackerman got up and she contested that. She contested basically everything that Mr. Daniel said. She said most of everything. And, of course, those cases, they're not in my brief, but this court knows those cases. But Cameron from the Court of Criminal Appeals on October 8th of 2014, it's a Bexar County case, discusses that standard. This court, actually, it was your opinion, Justice Dofano, in 2009, Seymour, S-E-Y-M-O-U-R, talks about that same standard. But then later, at page 7, it's the second volume, page 7, Mr. Daniel says, I'm not offering it as factual matters, and that's a quote from the record. So in other words, he stepped back, just as the prosecutor had contested his assertions about Ms. Langston's not being there. And when you look at the actual documents, you will find no return service, and also she wasn't called. Those are the requirements of 2402. I found a 1922 case from the Court of Criminal Appeals. It's Dixon, D-I-X-O-N, 238 Southwest 2nd, 227. And that shows that a duly served subpoena is one where there's a return. So the bottom line in this case also, if you dislike what happened with the magistrate in this case, 3823B kicks in. Good faith. We have a warrant in this situation. Texas has a limited good faith standard. This is one of those where it applies. The officers were entitled to rely on this warrant because it definitely has probable cause and was properly issued. The state asks that this court reverse the trial court's fact findings and conclusions and send this back so this person can be prosecuted for enhanced DWI with a prior misdemeanor. Thank you.
Thank you. Your case is submitted.